Backseat Producers, episode 265, Return to Oz. This is Tony.
And this is Tony.
And that's it. We are the Backseat Producers.
Yeah.
Welcome to Fanboy Smackdown.
No kidding.
We're getting really close to the anniversary.
Yeah. And it was about this time 7 years ago that we last talked about Walter Murch, too, so it'll all work out.
I don't know.
He's the director of this movie.
Wow. All right, so business. Next week, Argo.
All right.
I haven't made any plans after that. There have been a couple of different titles bandied about, so.
Skyfall's one.
Skyfall, I think we're going to wait till toward the end of April.
Okay.
A release date toward the end of April. I guess, well, you know what? The 29th of April would be the last Monday in April. Our first Fanboy Smackdown episode was the 30th of April.
Really?
Yeah.
My brother's birthday.
Yeah, so.
Is that the one he came to?
No, he came to the third one.
Okay.
He came to, because the first, we recorded the first two.
They were Star Wars.
They were Star Wars. Well, it was Star Wars. It was the original trilogy versus the prequel trilogy.
Right.
That was episode one. Episode two was Lucas's other films.
Right.
And then the third episode was the Batman movies.
Right.
And that's the one your brother came to.
Okay.
That was the first one he came to. He's come to another.
You come to like two more, yeah.
Yeah.
Two other ones.
After 260-some episodes, I don't remember who else come to everyone.
Yeah.
And if you mention a movie more than like 5 to 10 years old, hey, have you guys done, unless I absolutely know that we haven't done it, or if we've even talked about a movie, it's like, I don't know, we talked about it, I don't remember if we did that one. I need to go look.
I know, because newsflash for the people who are already listening, we don't always cover just the movie that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And sometimes we spend more time on a movie we didn't decide to cover than the one which we inadequately covered for the episode.
Yeah, speaking of a movie that we kind of covered in the process of covering another movie, I started rewatching Primer.
Oh, nice.
It's on a Netflix instant streaming right now. And I watched like the first 15 minutes, and I was busy doing other stuff. And it was that movie, you can't be busy doing stuff.
No, it's too involved. That's a good movie.
It is. It is. And what's funny is, I mean, it's been a while since we talked about that.
Probably it's been 5 years.
Yeah, probably close to it. And just watching the first 15 minutes, I didn't remember the details of watching that, what I watched. But watching it the first time, I can see where I was completely confused about what the movie was. This time, I'm still a little confused, but knowing in general terms what the theme of the movie is, I'm really digging all the detail and the quick dialogue. And I mean, it's really cool because they do things that you really shouldn't do in movies. There are scenes when four guys are talking over each other. You know, there are two different conversations in the same room at the same time going on, and they have all the dialogue at the same volume. So you get this cacophony of discussion going on, and you can get lost and mixed up in the two discussions. It's kind of cool because it's like that's how
people talk.
People, yeah. Especially in that kind of situation. We do it here.
Yeah.
Like there are times when Adam and I start having a conversation, you and Darryl having a conversation, then all of a sudden it switches and everybody's talking together at the same time. And
yep.
Yeah, it's really cool. I'm enjoying rewatching it. Because I got to thinking about favorite movies and things like that. It's like, man, I really like that movie, but I kind of want to go back to it and revisit it before I...
Are you going
to
release a critical list of your favorite movies for the podcast?
No.
I just wanted a reason to say critical list.
No.
It came to me.
No, though, actually, I started...
just using it as a stalking horse for some other idea. I don't
know. Actually, so I'm listening to... we just watched a movie. It's a new podcast by Stingray, Jonathan Holmberg, who used to be on Backseat Box Office with me. He and his, I think it's his brother-in-law and a buddy of theirs, they're doing this movie podcast. They've totally swiped our format.
Really?
Which is fine.
You mean two guys drinking and talking about movies with a mic on?
No, the
or
the,
four guys now?
The format of talking about your high-level thoughts, then the acting, direction, and how we kind of set that format for a while. And sometimes we follow it, and mostly we don't.
Well, Tony, we're going to flip that format on its head today. I want to know your low-level thoughts to begin with.
My low-level thoughts is I want to kick you in the balls.
It's usually how the podcast ends, so that's good. So we're doing reverse order. That's right.
Yeah. No. Anyway, so I'm listening to their show, and their shtick is they took Time's, a couple of years ago, Time released the 100 best movies list, and they didn't rank them. And then afterward, they added some more to the list.
Oh, Time did.
Time magazine.
Yeah, AFI ranked them.
AFI did rank
them. That's right. Okay. Yeah.
But Christiana Ellis is already doing the AFI list. So they didn't want to copy that. So they took the Time list. They have also taken up the challenge of ranking them.
Nice.
So what they're doing is as they watch a movie, they put it on their rank, on their rank chart. And each of them individually keeps their own ranking chart.
Nice.
So there's three of them. So the rankings are all different based on their, on what they like and dislike. They're about their fifth or sixth episode at this point. The funny thing is they've started shifting things around between episodes because they've changed their minds.
Yeah, well, how can you rank a movie without having seen all 100?
Well, see, the thing is they started watching the movies, and like a movie they used to have at number one is now at number three, but the movie that was at number three is now at number two.
Right.
Like, so they start shifting the movies up and down their lists.
And I have a question. I don't know if you know the answer, but is it American movies only, like the AFI, or is it like all movies?
No,
it's not. So it's a totally different list then.
Basically. Yes, it's a totally different list.
Yeah, so...
Because if they had a way to do it, they actually, Jonathan actually asked me to see if there was a way they could get you on the podcast. But there was, like, the logistics of it wouldn't have worked out because their third, fourth episode was Raging Bull.
Oh, man, I would have loved to do that.
Yeah, so the episode's out there. You can go listen to it. And I'm sure they will gladly take your thoughts on it. One of the funny things they do, though, because Jonathan makes no bones about the fact, like in the last episode, he's like, so we're going to just keep right on going with the fact we blatantly stole Backseat Producer's format here. They have on their show notes, one of the tallies they keep is the number of Backseat Producers references in each episode.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm slightly, whatever. Overwhelmed by, I'm flattered.
Yeah, so it's good, but it got me thinking because, so like the movie that I just listened to, they did King Kong, the original 1933 King Kong. And they're like, oh, this movie was, I don't see why it's on the 100 best list. It's like, yeah, sure, it was influential, but there have been better versions of this movie made since then. And how can you call it a best if, you know, you hold up the Peter Jackson version, and it's just a better movie overall.
That raises the interesting philosophical question of what makes a movie the best. Is it for what it did at that time,
right,
or is it for, does it, you know, yeah.
Yeah, so I started thinking about maybe coming up with a list of the so many most important movies. And then listing reasons why they're important. Not that they are the best, not that they are the first, but what makes this movie important? Why is it important in the historical context of film? And so I started thinking about that, and I think maybe after I get a couple of these novels knocked out, I'm going to seriously sit down and think about a book that lists that and do it, you know, under the Backseat Producers.
Do a critical piece?
Yeah.
That would be cool.
And take a look, you know, and really sit down and take a look at 20 You know, and you don't need to go crazy with 100 movies or something like that, but you do, you know, 20 to 50 movies, maybe even just 25 movies, and you write some good critical information about them and do some historical research about the movie and its influences, what influenced it, what it influenced, why it was important at the time.
See, that stuff is really fascinating.
And I think that would be fun.
I love that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I would love to do that. So... Yeah,
I'm, so that, so that I'm might be something that might be something we look at doing at some point in the future.
So I found I found the Raging Bull one. This is a huge bummer. I really would have liked to be on the spot. Although, you know, it wouldn't have been fair. I would have just been gushing about it. And
oh yeah,
it wouldn't have been.
It would have been ridiculous. But I'm sure they will gladly take your thoughts if you listen to the episode.
Hey, Jonathan ranked it number one on the movies they'd seen so far. Good call, Jonathan. 96 movies later, it's still going to be number one.
Well, there you
go. Spoiler. Anyway, no, just kidding.
All right.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, probably come up in a couple of weeks, we're actually going to play an episode of theirs. Give them a little boost. And if we ever need a break for a week, we'll toss an episode of theirs in the feed. So don't be surprised if you hear those guys on this feed here soon.
That would be awesome.
And I don't know what happened, but our numbers for March were way down. Our listener
really?
Numbers, which I'm not, you know, it happens. Plus, things have changed in Backseat Box Office.
How long have they been doing this? We watched a movie. I gotta say.
Oh, I don't know. That could be it.
It's about four episodes, about a month's worth. I mean, you know.
Actually, they just released their sixth episode today, so yeah, that explains a lot.
I would say there's a pretty direct
damn it, Holmberg. I will take your hands down and.
Well, it's a very clever strategy. Say backseat producers enough, and then before you know
they're gonna steal all our.
They become the backseat producers, and
I retire.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant. It's a brilliant strategy.
I did not think of that.
It's the Facebook Android phone. That's what this is. Anyway, no, I'm go ahead.
No, what's funny is so like we have a certain like average number, like an average daily number that. has been pretty standard for a couple of months. And that dipped last month. By April 2nd, we had like three times the downloads for April that we should have.
Well,
but it turns out what it appears happened is somebody somewhere figured out that we did Iron Skies.
And so they just started and going
that,
to town.
And that download just shot up. That movie has such this cult
following
that, yeah, the downloads for that particular episode just went through the roof.
Well, for those of you still listening, I'm sorry I hated it. But, you know, what are you going to do?
I just thought that was fascinating. That it was just like, whoa.
Well, we get those spikes from time to time when we did Kevin Smith, when we did Firefly.
Yep.
I think there have been a couple of others.
But yeah, it just seems that...
Those fandom spikes from time to time, which even everything out so we can justify continuing to do the show for another year. I mean, that's basically what happens, right?
Yeah. So. And on top of that, the Parsecs, the 2013 Parsecs now are in face. I am by
and
no means...
And we did not get nominated?
We didn't get nominated for the 2012.
Son of a... Oh, okay. That's old
2013. 2013 just started. Okay. And I think they go for a month or two.
Okay.
They take anybody can go to the website and nominate any podcast.
Well, in our defense, or in the defense of the people nominating, it's not like we ever like paid them any mind or lip service, really, for that matter, and justified them wanting to renominate us. I mean, over the years, we've just kind of been like, oh, great.
They don't nominate us. That's just it.
Well, the fans,
our
right?
fans do.
Oh, our fans nominate us. Oh.
So our fans are either slacker SOBs, which, hey, we are too. So that's fine. Or they've realized that, you know what, we aren't spec fic. We aren't really a speculative fiction podcast. Because that's the hook for the Parsec Awards, is they're all about speculative fiction. If you're not speculative fiction, you're not really nominated. You're not up for an award from them.
Or maybe,
which is fine.
Or maybe some of it is when we first got started, we had very passionate fans.
That's true.
Who we actually communicated with. We would get their voicemails and stuff. Mm-hmm. Since then, we've become somewhat insular, I mean, I would say. I mean, we do our thing, and those fans have moved on, and have made kids who probably do their own podcast now. And, you know, like, so maybe a lot of the enthusiasm is gone. We have been around a while, and I don't think it's anything about the fans, really. It's just kind of the way
No, I don't think it's about that at all.
You know?
Though I have already decided, and I sent out an email to you guys today, I've decided that if we get nominated, for whatever reason, as far-reaching as that thought may be, I'm going to clip. Now you, as listeners, you guys decide if you think this is worth us doing. If you think it's worth us doing, nominate us for the Parsec. Because what I'm going to do, if we get nominated, if we get asked for a submission, because the way it works is you get nominated, you get asked by the Parsec committee for a submission, you submit a 10-minute chunk of audio that can be taken from any three episodes, but it has to be three contiguous segments, so you can't just jump all around an episode or anything like. Can't do like a greatest hits thing.
Right.
You have to just take three segments, up to 10 minutes in length. It can be less; doesn't have to be a full 10. But and the last time we were nominated, which could be probably why we weren't nominated again. Or why they...
We sent The Last Temptation of Christ.
I sent The Last Temptation of Christ as our speculative fiction.
But that's like
fiction,
one of our best episodes.
As our speculative fiction podcast.
That is speculative fiction.
It is.
Last Temptation of Christ is probably the one speculative fiction film we actually did.
I know. I thought it was Rather Humans when I did it. But
it's pretty great.
Anyway, so what I'm going to do this time is I'm going to take the Listen Bitches rant from the beginning of The Hobbit.
That's probably my favorite moment of this podcast since Last Temptation of Christ.
When Daryl turned around to Adam and said, "Shut the fuck up."
That was
And I'm just
going to
clip.
Awesome.
I'm just going to clip from the beginning of his rant until the end of his rant. And I'm pretty sure that's less than 10 minutes, but it's probably a good 7 or 8.
You think so? You think it's that long?
I don't know if it's that long. I would say it's
the
probably
conversation five. Probably is, but when he rants, I don't think it's that long.
His rant is I think it's at least 5 minutes long. He just kept going and going. Yeah. Even if it's 3 minutes long, I'm going to take from the beginning of the rant to the end of the rant, and that's what I'm submitting.
Well, not to promote our own show or anything, but I'd say it's the finest 5 minutes in all of podcasting, actually.
It was pretty great. Especially if you've ever listened to this show. Just hearing Daryl just go off like that was just
amazing. I'm
going to
see if Daryl can get nominated for a Nobel Prize in Literature, or maybe maybe a Nobel Peace Prize.
A Hugo
That's
Award.
A Hugo Award. That's perfect. That's perfect.
Even better.
So we did The Hobbit. That didn't get any real play download-wise?
You know what? I haven't looked recently. I'd have to go back and look. But I can do that.
Well, you don't have to do it now. But I was
so... Let's go ahead and actually start talking about this movie.
No, we don't have to do that.
18 minutes in.
What are you talking about, Tony?
So, you were the one that suggested we watch this.
I did.
What did you think of it?
Well, let me first say why I suggested it.
Right.
The new movie, the Oz movie, came out. And first thing that occurred to me was, oh, I remember when I was a kid, a movie came out about Oz called Return to Oz. And I remembered it being pretty creepy when I was a kid. And I was like, I think it would be very interesting to go back and see that movie and see how it aged and talk about it in the context of both the original one, which is obviously a classic,
right,
and the new one, which I haven't seen, but you've seen.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back and watched it. And I actually feel, with the exception of obviously it's a kid's film, there's some hokey 80s stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
But I actually feel it's a good film. I think it held up pretty well. It's in some ways, now I've not read the books. Well, I read The Wizard of Oz. It was a very long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a much different experience than watching The Wizard of Oz, the movie.
Yes.
And it's my understanding that this movie is more faithful to the books than the original film, which is a classic and kind of supersedes now all of the Oz stuff, you know, that mm-hmm. Frank L. Baum did.
Yeah, everything. You can't do anything Oz without it being compared to
The movie.
The yeah. 39?
Yeah, 1939. Yep.
Yeah.
So, all that being said, I thought it was a good movie. It has a lot of great suspense in there for kids. It has a lot of, it's an overlay of the original movie, which may be what
yes.
was intended.
Yes, it
because
is.
Maybe the book's
oh
intended
my God,
as well.
Is it an overlay of the original?
But it's a much darker overlay, and I think at the very least it's interesting and worth seeing. So that's what I think. What do you think?
I think the biggest problem with this movie is that it didn't understand its audience. I think they took the approach of going back to the original material and taking from that to create the story. And specifically, according to the credits, now I haven't read the book, so I don't know how faithfully it touches on these movies, but the two books that it credits as being, as getting a story from it are The Land of Oz and Ozma of Oz.
Yep.
You're absolutely right that it is an overlay of the story that's presented in the 1939 movie and probably in the book. I think the framework of the story, I think there's like an established formula. For what an Oz story is, and this follows that.
Yes.
There is Dorothy going to Oz in a storm with an animal, finding the analogs of the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion, and traveling with them, fighting an evil force of creepy critters that come after her in the wheelies. Mm-hmm. There's an evil force and an evil witch that is chasing after her, and she has to confront this bigger-than-life wizard to solve the problem in the end. I mean,
right. Same, yeah.
If you break it down to those elements, well, all of those elements fit both the 39 and this movie to a T.
Yeah.
They also even go so far as characters that are introduced in Kansas show up, or their analogs show up in Oz.
Even objects in Kansas become versions of things.
Yes.
In Oz. Which I was really
neat. You know what? It's one of those things that, that's what makes an Oz movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was okay with that. I almost wish they wouldn't have gone so much with the characters that were analogs of characters that they already had. Because, the premise of the story, she comes back to Oz, and everyone in the Emerald City is frozen. The Emerald City has been
destroyed.
It's in ruins, and like we see the Lion, we see the Tin Man, and they are stone. They're made of stone. So the first character she meets in the world is TikTok, which is pretty much just the Tin Man.
Yeah,
it's just a different version of the Tin Man, including his flaw of not having life. He's not alive.
Right.
Which the Tin Man didn't have a heart. So you have comparisons there, but that's the thing that saved him. And that's the reason that he is available to be a companion to her.
A big difference between this movie and the other movie though, is the old movie played it up for laughs. The Tin Man who didn't have a heart always cried, always had all these feelings. The Scarecrow who didn't have a brain always had an idea.
Right.
The Lion was genuinely scared, but that was played over the top for laughs.
Sure.
But this is played very straight. Like, you know, it's very much a quest movie.
Yes. I mean,
it's not the comedic, you know, 1939.
So no, it's different in tone. It's not a musical.
No.
That's a huge derivation from it. And what I'm frankly okay with.
Yeah.
I enjoy musicals when, I think I like the musicals best when music plays a central theme to the story, not just that they're singing every song.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Phantom, because it takes place in an opera house and they're singing, so it makes sense that they're singing and they communicate through song. That I'm okay with.
Right.
Les Mis, I don't. I know there's a great love for the songs and a great love for the story. I'm on record with the problems I have with it. I've already told Julie that at some point I'm going to sit down with a notebook and I'm going to watch that movie again. And I'm going to take notes about every point that I have this. Because I swear.
It's just not worth it, Tony.
Daryl's rant for The Hobbit was nothing compared to the rant Julie got as we walked out of
Les Mis. Here's the good news. Most people agree with you about Les Mis.
No. There are a lot of people that don't. A whole lot of people that
really?
Don't, which is why the movie was as successful as it was.
Even my brother, who speaks French, and has seen like four different versions of Les Mis, is like, yeah, the story's crap. I watch it because it's in French. Or like, the version he watches is in French. And I was like, all right, well, it's
in French. The story is terrible.
Yeah.
No, I like musicals to a point. I was glad to see the story not as a musical.
Yeah, and that actually even occurred to me, which is interesting. I didn't even think about that.
It's not a musical. Dorothy is an appropriate age for Dorothy. Judy Garland was much older than Dorothy should have been.
Right.
And was more mature.
Yes.
Than Julie should have, or than
although, you know, the Dorothy thing that kept throwing me was the blue eyes. Blue eyes kept throwing me because it kept taking me out of the story because Judy Garland has those big brown eyes. I mean, it's iconic. Not that it really makes a difference, but I just kept thinking, it looks like Dorothy, but she's got these cold blue eyes, although it probably fits this version better.
It's another difference.
Yeah.
This version is now the 39 movie has moments of darkness and moments of creepiness. This movie has a darker tone in general. It is more creepy, more scary. I mean, when we talked about doing this, I was like, oh, maybe I'll watch it with the kids. And I rented it and started watching it one night, and I watched about the first half an hour of it, and I was like, I need to get some sleep. But that first half an hour, especially, they're like in the doctor's office, and they're like, just relax. We're going to put this on the head and suck your dreams out. I'm like, oh, hell no.
You're not going to watch that with your kids, huh?
And then when she shows up in Oz and the wheelies come after her, it's like, no.
It's genuinely frightening as a kid when I saw this.
I
remember this being one of the scariest movies I'd ever seen. And it was like, so
this movie came out in 84.
Yeah.
So you, I mean.
But I saw it about 5 years
later. You probably saw it later. So you were probably, what, 10, 11 years old?
Nine. I was nine when I saw it.
Yeah.
And I remember.
I bet Holden would crap his pants watching this movie at this point.
But it left an impression. I mean, you can't say it's not a kid's story because all of the Grimm tales and some of these other classic tales have a genuine darkness and scariness to them.
It really does have a fairy tale vibe to it.
Yeah.
More a fairy tale vibe than the 39 movie did.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, I look at fairy tales as having some real visceral harshness to them, and this movie does.
Yeah,
I mean, and there's some stuff that's really cruel in it too. So the first time she goes to the queen, when she goes to the queen, and the queen's talking about how she can take her head, and she's like, and just that whole concept is really creepy.
Yeah.
So the queen like has this collection of heads of beautiful women, so she can just swap them out at will.
Right.
And but what she says to her, she says something to the effect that, you're not pretty, but in a few years, you may become somewhat pretty.
Right. And so I could use your head then.
And so I could use your head then. Once you've matured and grown into your somewhat prettiness or something.
And this is also after you watch her physically take off one head and grab another one from the chamber, which incidentally, the heads move while they're in the... The special effects in this movie for their time, in my opinion, are very good. Now, there's some claymation stuff where you go, oh, well, obviously, that's really fake. But there are some things that are really well done.
I think the worst of the special effects was the Rock King.
Yeah.
And when they kept moving that face around, what was clever about it was you can kind of see where they got the idea for Gollum, though. Where you had the one face that kept representing two different characters.
Mm-hmm.
It kept shifting to the side and being very blocky. And then it was the king. And then it became real angular. And it was that minion type voice. That was weird.
And while you bring that up, because I think the movies... I would not say it's a great movie, but I think it's an interesting movie and it's underappreciated in terms of its influence and some of the things that it did for other movies. For example, you bring up the Gollum thing. Jack the Pumpkin King is in this movie.
Yep.
And it's not subtle where they got the
Jack
idea.
Jack Pumpkinhead is Jack Skellington.
Yes, absolutely.
Jesus is that Jack Skellington.
Yes. And so
and it's the Jack Skellington you see at the beginning of Nightmare Before Christmas, because he actually, at the very beginning of Nightmare Before Christmas, he actually has the pumpkin head.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And he catches it on fire, and he jumps into the well. Right. Yeah. When he comes out of the well, he just has the skeleton head.
Right.
That is Jack Skellington.
Yeah.
And they even call him Jack. It's Jack Pumpkinhead in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is no subtlety about that at all. But both distributed by Disney.
Well, true. And so they owned the underlying rights, and so they owned they even owned the underlying rights to the characters, so there was no issue of...
Right. There's no issue of copyright or even image.
Right. It didn't make rights. A difference.
So, yeah.
So, well, did you like the film?
You know, I didn't like it as I was watching it, mostly because I'm not the audience for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that I thought it was a bad movie. It just wasn't for me. Stepping back from it, taking it as a whole, I think it suffered a little bit from having a lot going on. There's a lot going on in this movie. There's a lot of characters in this movie. Some of which are only served by being plot points to get characters from one point to another.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the Gump? I can't remember what that thing is called. The moose head couch with the palm leaves the broom tail thing. Clever. But
unnecessary,
although
he has a few choice lines.
He does have a few choice
lines. One of my favorite lines is, I should have quit when I was ahead. I thought that was a great line.
They did have some moments of really clever dialogue.
Yeah.
Sometimes they had characters talking just to talk. That chicken, I was about ready to eat fried chicken after about the first 10 minutes, because everything out of that damn chicken's mouth was just inane chatter.
Right, but the chicken serves as a confessor for Dorothy to explain what she knows about the world.
It's an expository character.
Right.
You need that character for Dorothy to say, oh, look, here's the world we live in.
Right, right.
I get that. If Dorothy was doing all the talking,
chicken was annoying.
That chicken was annoying as shit.
It's the Jar Jar Binks of Oz.
It is, yes. I was like, you know, Dorothy left that chicken in Oz. Dorothy is wise beyond her years. Poor Ozma got stuck with that damn chicken. The things that are clever, that are merely clever in the 39 version, they do things that take it to like, almost like a Willy Wonka-esque level in this movie. The first item that Dorothy and what's the name? I can't remember the chicken's
Belina.
Name. Belina. Because at first I thought she was mispronouncing. I was like, oh, that's clever. It's Melina. No, it's Belina. But the first thing they interact with is that lunchbox, the lunch pail tree. It's like, that's kind of cool. Because it's something, she's like, oh, it's a lunchbox tree. We're definitely in Oz.
Yeah, yeah. And I would imagine, even though, once again, we keep saying, well, we haven't read the books, but those seem to me to be things that were probably in the books, and they just, like, poured them over right away.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
I would imagine. And it was neat because it's something very different and very fanciful, especially the whole thing. She pulls it down. She opens it up. She looks down into it. It looks like the inside of an apple, like if you'd cut an apple. It kind of has that look of an apple core to it.
Mm-hmm.
She reaches in, pulls out a wrapped ham sandwich. It's like, that's just clever.
Yeah.
That's really cool fantasy for that age.
Right.
For like that 10 to 12 year old, that's kind of cool. And that's something, you know, doesn't exist in real life.
Right.
But it's something that, man, wouldn't that be cool if that existed? You're out playing with your buddies in the woods and you run across a lunch pail tree.
Yeah.
So you don't even have to go home. You just pull a lunch pail down, have some lunch. Keep playing, you know?
Yep.
I mean, I can see at that age going, man, that would be really convenient.
Yeah. Yeah. So the sense of the kid's wonder is genuinely there in some respects.
I think so. And I think the creepiness of having some of those oddball characters, some of the oddball situations that Jack Pumpkinhead finds himself in, like when the Gump starts falling apart and they fall, she just happens to land right on the couch. And the head lands upside down on Jack.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's appropriate for that 10 to 12 age range, but I'm going to say for a kid in the 80s.
Yeah.
I don't think a 12, I think a 10-year-old might think it's creepy now, But a 12-year-old...
Cheesy now.
It's cheesy, yeah. And it's... I think they're just more sophisticated, and they're... The creepiness is more just from the in-your-face nature of some of the characters. And seeing some of the stuff that Holden watches, I'm like, man, I don't know if he'd enjoy this in a couple of years. But right now, he's a little bit too young because of how creepy it is.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think there's a really narrow margin for the audience of this movie, unless you just have a really great nostalgia for Oz, and you're just into Oz in general.
I would agree, and I think, and that might speak to a larger problem of trying to port over fantasies which were genuinely creepy at that time. Like, another one, it's not as creepy, but let's say Sleeping Beauty, for example. Mm-hmm. If you're a young person, you watch Sleeping Beauty, maybe you're not 9, but maybe you're 6 or 7. There's some scenes in Sleeping Beauty which are genuinely frightening, with the witch and all that stuff. But that being said, nobody really sees that as, like, I think you almost are not even taken in by the fantasy anymore. And I think it's more about the cultural references that this generation is growing up with, where there is no real sense of, like, true fantasy. I mean, anything that's fantastical is usually sci-fi now, or in some ways a part of that world, as opposed to a castle or a foreign land in a globe or something like that. I mean,
it's coming out of Disney. A lot of it's coming out of Disney's fairy tales still. Out of the fantasy stuff. Because, I mean, you still have... Disney's still making princess movies.
But they're not, like, frightening. They're toned down.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're not like... Like, Snow White, that was another one where it was like... You know, that was made in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And that one was... That witch was genuinely frightening, and there were some genuinely frightening scenes. And...
Now, I don't know if you've seen Brave, but there's some genuinely frightening stuff at points in Brave, because there's this ridiculously huge bear that plays a big part of the story, and that bear is menacing in a few of the scenes. But
it's not like fantasy, like the wonder of magic of this person being able to do, you know, X, Y, or Z, have that kind of power.
It does exist in Brave. Brave has a sense of magic and fantasy to it.
It's in Harry Potter, but that's a different, I would say, different age group.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah, and you know, looking at it now, maybe the better analog to that is looking at Harry Potter in relation to, you know, the Harry Potter books moved into movies and the Oz books moved into movies. Mm-hmm. There have been a ton of Oz movies.
Really?
Yeah. There's been the original. There was a Wizard of Oz movie before the 39 version.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. I think it was Silent. It was one of the early movies. There was a movie called Witches of Oz. There was the sci-fi miniseries Tin Man.
Really?
Recommended.
Really?
Recommended.
That's interesting.
It's, I'll give you a little bit of a spoiler. The main character is played by Zooey Deschanel.
Okay.
And she plays a character.
I've seen that on DVD.
She plays the character DG.
It's a limited series, right?
Yeah, it's a miniseries.
That's right.
It was like a 3-episode miniseries.
Alan
Cumming is in it.
Alan Cumming is. Oh yeah, and the dude from I wanted to rent this when I.
Yeah, it's a
when I saw it.
It's yeah. I actually watched it as it aired on Sci-Fi, and it's really good. And they get to a point where
Neil McDonough, he's good.
Yeah, I like Neil McDonough. They get to a point where she interacts with the Grey Gale, and the Grey Gale is the original Dorothy in black and white.
Oh, nice.
But it's yeah, so it's like because she is a an ancestor.
Well,
of Dorothy Gale.
I kind of want to see this now. I almost want to do this episode now.
And maybe we can. I mean, maybe we can do that at some point. But that's a good one. And Oz the Great and Powerful. Yeah, I saw it. It's definitely more for a kid audience. I took the kids to it. They both enjoyed it. It doesn't have the creepiness factor to it. It's not a musical. And they did things like, Zach Braff plays a character in Kansas, and then when Oscar is the character's name that goes to Oz, he goes up in a balloon and gets sucked into a tornado and goes to Oz. He runs into a character that's a flying monkey that is the voice. It has the voice of Zach Braff. So they still do that thing where they carry characters over from Kansas into Oz. And
interesting side note: the 100th episode of Scrubs, which Zach Braff directed, mm-hmm. is a play on The Wizard of Oz. There are references all throughout the episode.
I don't remember that one. I'd have to rewatch that specific episode. So I've seen them all.
I don't know if he's got a
fascination
with Oz and wanted to be in the movie, or I don't know.
It's yeah, maybe.
Interesting.
I'm not sure.
But
so I have seen the new movie. The beginning of it is a little rough. It's a little bit manic and kind of fractured. Then probably about 45 minutes to an hour in, it starts hitting a good pace. Unfortunately, it's kind of uneven until you get to that point. And then it starts hitting a good pace, and you start getting some interesting character reveals. You start learning the characters that you were introduced to are turning into characters that they will be by the time you get to the Wizard of Oz story.
Interesting.
Like, you're introduced to the Wicked Witch of the West before she's the Wicked Witch of the West.
Hmm.
And you actually see her go from a character that is a you know, pale-skinned human, and she actually turns into the green-skinned Wicked Witch while she's, you know, on screen. That happens on screen.
That's cool.
You see, and it's directly related to the wizard. So he is taking a part in the origin stories of some of these other characters as they advance into the story.
Is this based on a Baum novel?
I don't think so. But it's definitely a prequel to the 39 movie.
Okay.
Because they visit the land of the Munchkins, and you get introduced to the Munchkins and the Tinkers and some other characters that end up, some of that stuff ends up coming back in the 39 movie. One of the interesting things that they do is the character that becomes the Wicked Witch. At one point, he upsets her so much, and he's not aware of it, but she cries. Scars, burning scars, are down her face as she's crying, because in the 39 movie, you throw water on the witch and makes her melt.
Oh,
her tears
smart.
Are melting her face away.
That's smart. That's cool.
There was some clever moments like that. They did things like they showed how he was an illusionist and how he used flash bombs and different things and illusions and things like that. They showed how he used smoke pots to make billowing pots of smoke and a projector to project a face on it, which is how they did it in the 39 movie to make the big head of Oz appear in the great room. So they spent a lot of time setting up all that stuff. And in the end, the movie, it told a decent story, and you could tell they had some fun with some of it. I think it was really uneven at the beginning, and it is definitely made for kids.
Okay.
It's definitely a...
different from Return to Oz.
I think they're both made for kids. Tonally, completely different.
And the new one would have more in common with the original.
It has more in common tonally. It's a lighter tone. Though there is some serious stuff about how he's kind of a womanizer and a player.
Okay.
But that goes to show how he, you know, he uses women and kind of tosses them to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And that works against him. And, you know, he ends up hurting a woman very badly, and it turns her into the Wicked Witch of the West.
Oh, okay.
So, because of his presumed betrayal, that turns her against all of Oz. Because she just wants revenge. Hmm. And the concept there is easy enough for a kid to understand. You get hurt, you want revenge. So it's not a complicated love story or anything like that. I think the tone is light enough that it's more comparable to the 39 version than Return to Oz. I think Return to Oz is just a much darker movie overall.
Okay.
I did like how things that I liked and didn't like. I liked how they made the Tin Man look like a Tin Man. Like a man made out of...
In Return to Oz?
In Return to Oz.
Oh, yeah.
I liked how the lion
was a lion.
Looked like a lion.
Yeah.
I hated the scarecrow.
He looked like a scarecrow, though. But he looked ridiculous.
He looked ridiculous.
But he had more of a whatever. He looked like, I'm made of straw, and
he looked more like he looked more like something you'd see in a mall.
Yes.
Or a stuffed animal. His face just bugged me.
Yeah, it was a cartoony comic face. A scarecrow wouldn't have that face. But I mean, they definitely, I think, played up more the clumsy. If he was really made of straw, and he was, you know.
Which is the, I mean, that's what they did with Jack Pumpkinhead too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so how that, you know, bumbling idiot becomes the King of Oz, well, that might be the root of all their problems, which is why this movie ended up being made, but, you know, it's...
They did a lot of really clever things with the movie, though. I liked how the Rock King, whatever he was...
I liked him a lot.
I liked
it's the one of my favorite memories from the movie as a kid. When I watched it again, I remember going, oh, this is great.
You know, I like the motivation. A lot of times you have villains with really stupid motivations. And he plays with the motivation, and he messes with Dorothy's head so much.
Yes.
It's fantastic. Where she's like, hey, this isn't fair. You've stolen all the emeralds from the Emerald City. He's like, so, let me get this straight. And that's what I love about him, because he's just totally just playing with her.
Yes.
And he's like, so let me get this straight. If somebody takes something from you, you feel that they should give you that back, right? And she's like, well, yeah. Well, if they don't give it back, don't you think you have the right to just take it back from them? And she's like, yeah, I guess. And he's like, well, I'm kind of a mountain.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of made of rock. And what is emerald if it's not crystal and made from rock? So the way I see it, this was all stolen from me first.
And yeah.
It's like, wow.
He's a great.
That's a great twist on it. And he's really good at manipulating words and manipulating the situation, but not so much that it's like, it's going to be confusing.
Right.
I think the arguments were perfect for the age level too, but still clever enough that I'm watching this as a 40-year-old going, well, that's good.
And there are Faustian bargains that he makes with her throughout.
Yes.
And it was so interesting, because I remember when the Gnome King comes up, and I thought...
The Gnome King, yeah.
I remember, like, I'm going back, I'm watching this, and I'm like, I remember him being a good guy, but I also remember him being bad. That's all I remembered. I was like, I thought he was good at first, but I also remember, like, he dies in the end, or something bad happens to him. So I'm like, I wonder why I remember he's good, because clearly he's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But he gives them, like... refreshments, and he offers them a deal, and it's like, oh,
he is very much like the analog of Satan.
Yes, he really is.
He's charming. He's well spoken. He's not menacing. He's creepy, but he's not menacing.
And he becomes more and more human each time another one becomes, which I thought was kind of.
To the point where he's actually a person.
Yes.
That has makeup on.
Which I'm pretty sure he's the doctor.
Yeah. He is the doctor.
Yeah. Okay.
He's the doctor, and the witch is the...
The assistant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And they even showed that at the very end.
They showed the witch, but they didn't show the guy.
No, it is definitely him, because they... Yeah, it's definitely him. I like... And then when he's... When he reveals the ruby slippers,
that he was wearing
the ruby slippers, she's like, hey, give those back. He's like, they fell from the sky. You were too busy trying to get home to come back for them. So he didn't say it, but it was basically finders keepers.
Right.
He's like, you left them. You took off.
And he reveals his nature there too, because he's like, did you really come back for someone you cared about? Didn't you really come back for these things?
Yeah.
It's all materialistic. He's like, come on. He's like, let's level with me. There's no way you actually came back for the scarecrow. Who cares? You came back for these because these have power. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought that was pretty cool too.
It was clever. Like when they go into the mountain, from then on, the story was good.
Yeah.
That from that until the end, it was really good. There were points of unevenness and some goofiness before that, but from then on, I really liked it after that.
The only part that I really didn't like is the part with the moose. because it's so convoluted. But it's that one point where there's a, I don't know if you want to call it like a children's magic or it's kind of like a suspension of disbelief for them to get out of that mirrored castle with that creepy lady with all the heads, because it's up until that point, I would say the film strikes a very frightening and violent tone mm-hmm. from the beginning of the movie up until the very point where they actually get a breath of fresh air and sprinkle that magic dust on that moose. They get out of there, and then you start to feel
there's some relief.
A little lighter there. The only part I didn't like, actually. But
you catch your breath. It's the one point when you finally got to, you get to breathe. It's like, oh, they escaped. They're free. But then they started amping it back up because then the wheelies start following them again.
Right.
And then they get to that desert where the one wheelie goes into the desert. It just turns into sand.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, man, things just got weird again.
Yeah. So it was, I would say outside of the scene that you talked about in the beginning of the podcast, I would say the rest of the film held up pretty well. I do think that scene with the moose, even though it is kind of a light-hearted scene.
The scene with the moose and...
is weak.
And I think that the other weak part for me was right after Dorothy gets to Oz and the chicken starts talking. I didn't have a problem with the chicken. One, I didn't have a problem with the chicken talking. It's Oz. I'm right. Okay with that. I didn't have a problem with Dorothy using the chicken as an expository character to explain, we're in Oz, things are different here. Where are we? You know, oh, that's the house we used to live in. And I was looking at the house going, where's Munchkin Land? Because that should have happened in Munchkin Land. And then all of a sudden they reveal they're on the Yellow Brick Road and it's trashed. It's like, that was cool. Yeah. I liked that. But just the chicken just started, just there was a, they couldn't leave a moment of silence through that part at all. The chicken's just constantly chattering when Dorothy's not. And it's like...
it's comic relief that I think was... that's probably when they made Jar Jar Binks. They were like, oh, this will be hilarious. And you're just like, oh.
If that character gosh. Just didn't... If they would have cut two-thirds of the chicken's dialogue, it would have helped that portion of the movie. And unfortunately, that was so far in the beginning of when she got to Oz. I'm like, oh my God. If this is how the rest of Oz is going to be, I'm just going to check out. Because it just annoyed me that badly. And it's like, and that's unfortunate because...
Jar Jar Binks factor.
Yeah, it got better. It just kept getting better after that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I joked about kicking you in the sack at the beginning. And...
it was a low-level high. Thoughts.
I don't think I'm ever going to watch the movie again. I don't feel bad that I watched it. I mean, I felt bad about some of the movies we watched for the podcast. I wouldn't say that I'd feel bad about it. I don't feel the need to ever watch it again. And I don't know that I can really recommend it unless you're a fan of, if you're a big fan of Oz and not just, and I'm not talking Wicked and I'm not talking
The Wiz.
The Wiz. If you're a fan of The Wiz, watch this movie.
It'll screw with your mind forever.
Oh man. And then watch Wicked.
Right.
And then just try to think about them all in continuity.
it'll blow your mind.
Yeah, it will. Unless you're a big fan of the Oz books, I can't see recommending it. They had some cool concepts. I actually liked the concept of TikTok, that he had three different
wind-ups.
He had a wind-up for his voice, he had a wind-up for his actions, and he had a wind-up for his brain. Mm-hmm. And if you had one without the other... you had weird consequences. He had actions that had no thought behind them. Or he would say things that were gibberish because there was no thought. He could do actions, but if he did too much action, then he ran out quicker. So he fought the wheelies, and then all of a sudden he was frozen. Oh, this sucks. I must have fought the wheelies too much. Now I'm just stuck here.
Right.
I can think and I can talk, but I can't move. So I just liked that character and the... some of the interesting things you could do with a character like that. Almost kind of want to steal that character because I think you could have some interesting stories just about TikTok.
Yeah.
You know, interacting with Oz. Because it's also a character that can be 1,000 years old. Guaranteed.
Yeah.
Guaranteed to last 1,000 years.
I mean, I guess my conclusory thoughts on the movie, I didn't know necessarily how I would feel watching it again. I think I genuinely like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a part of that that's based in nostalgia. I mean, I'm not going to deny that.
That's fair.
But I also think And I think the introduction has a lot to do with it. The 20 minutes where she's going to get basically, like, fried.
Lobotomized?
Right.
Man.
Created a genuine sense of fear and suspense for the character. When I was a kid, I would have been afraid. Now I'm just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're going to do this.
That is creepy.
Right. And I think that was so successful that it set up my suspension of disbelief for the rest of the film, mm-hmm. even through the hokey parts. And so I thought overall, like, it held together really well. And I think it's also a good timepiece because if you like the kind of 80s, you know, Labyrinth and you know, E.T. and things of that nature, mm-hmm. this, to me, falls in line with a lot of that.
It does, but I will say the effects in other movies were far more polished.
Well, that's true.
Now, there are some exceptions, like the scenes in the castle, in the witch's castle with the heads, that was all really well done. The scenes with the Gump.
Yeah, they were weak.
They were weak.
I never figured out how that sofa could move around when he wasn't flying.
Yeah. It's like, flap your wings. I don't have wings. Oh, well, I guess I do then.
Well, but not only that, how he's like actually like moving around, and you're kind of like, although I will say this, it's just as good as the Hobbit special effects.
Pretty close.
When they're flying around.
Oh, yeah.
Those mountains. So I guess my high level is, I liked it. I can't deny that a lot of it's based on the fact that I think it's because I've seen it before. You know.
I think talking about it, it's a better movie than I thought it was when I watched it. But I think that was because some of the unevenness of the storytelling and then just my dislike of some of the scenes in the movie that threw me off when things got better after that. You know, it's like, this damn talking chicken.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, and then some cool stuff happened after that.
Yeah.
But I, you know, was so turned off by what I had seen before that I kind of started checking out. And it's unfortunate because there were parts of the movie toward the end that were really good.
Just some, like, housekeeping items. I brought up Walter Murch at the beginning of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about him because he was the sound editor on THX.
He worked
with George Lucas on a ton of movies. He was in Lucas's editing department for a lot. He even edited Captain EO.
Huh.
He also edited the Godfather trilogy and Godfather Part 3 in the original version. He's edited most of the 2000s. Let's see here. The sound department, that's his big thing. His big breakthrough was THX. And I guess he's won. Oh, he did American Graffiti. He did Godfather Part 2 as a sound montage and sound re-recordist. So I guess this was his first crack, and probably because of its failure in the box office, his only crack at a major motion picture. He directed the Clone Wars TV series, some of the episodes. But other than that,
I wonder if they were the good or the bad episodes.
Let's see.
There's some uneven episodes in
the General. Clone Wars. He directed The General. I don't know.
I haven't watched too many of them. Some of them were pretty decent. Some of them were less than.
Okay. I haven't seen any of them. But he basically came out of the Lucasfilm tradition, and the only major motion picture he directed was this film. So, interesting stuff. And that's it. That's all I know. Oh, Fairuza Balk.
Yeah.
She ended up growing up into a decent character actor.
And a quirkily attractive woman.
If you like, what's the name of the singer? Avril Lavigne?
Yeah.
you'll probably like Fairuza Balk.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good, and her name is because when her father looked at her, it was, I can't remember what language. He's from a Middle Eastern descent.
I would say Fairuza is like.
And it's like Fairuza was the name that was the word they said, and it's blue, or it's
blue eyes.
It's like blue or no, it's turquoise, and it was because of her eyes.
Persian.
Okay. I want to say that the implication was that those eyes weren't the color that he was going to expect.
Oh.
And because of that, shortly afterwards, he and his wife separated.
Really?
That was the implication. They didn't come out and say that, but I saw that on the IMDb page that that shortly after that they had separated.
Well, it's IMDb, so you never know.
I mean, yeah, it's true.
They report rumor just as fast as they. However, I would say this. The blue eyes are definitely the thing that arrests you about her, both as an adult, as in a child, as an actress. Because in the movie, Return to Oz, that was the first thing I was like.
They're striking.
Yeah.
They really are strikingly blue.
Yeah. So, very interesting. All right. I got nothing else.
Well, I've been trying to see if I could find the information on The Hobbit. How many downloads we had.
Oh, okay.
And I'm getting close to that data now.
Oh, baby.
Let's see. Let's sort this in an appropriate way.
Also, one of the Hensons worked on Return to Oz.
That's not a surprise. I would say things like Jack Skeleton Head, or not Skeleton, Jack Pumpkin Head, and the Gump.
Mm-hmm.
Really struck me as things that would be something that could come out of Henson's shop.
Brian Henson was Jack Pumpkinhead.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. He was the son of Jim and Jane Henson.
And I saw a headline the other day that Jane Henson just died.
Really?
Yeah.
That's sad.
We only have 240 downloads on that episode. Other ones surrounding that episode are higher.
What's up, Middle Earth? Why aren't you downloading this episode? It's like,
what? People don't want to watch The Hobbit. What's that about?
Yeah, until the 5-hour version comes out on DVD, it's not going to matter anyway. We need to go back and review the 5-hour version.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Maybe at Archon in a couple years.
So just to round out some of the, you know, we Jim Henson and George Lucas are the masters, and they mm-hmm. have their tree of people, right? So Walter Murch is one. Brian Henson worked on The Great Muppet Caper, The Muppets Take Manhattan. He worked on Return to Oz. He worked on Labyrinth.
Okay.
He worked on The Jim Henson Hour, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Dinosaurs, The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Not the mama.
Muppets from Space. He's done all the Muppet stuff for The Muppets Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
Interesting. So he is Jack and the Beanstalk, the real story. He's got a pretty interesting filmography as a puppeteer, director, voiceover, producer. Muppet Treasure Island, I remember that one. So he's another guy that came off the Lucasfilm Henson, you know, creative tree from that time, from the 80s. When he made that movie, he was only 21.
Wow.
He was already doing, so on The Great Muppet Caper and The Muppets Take Manhattan, he was maybe 16. He was already doing puppeteering, performing. So, pretty interesting. Good for him. That's cool. Cool career.
Yeah, I was just going to check the trivia to see if there was anything else interesting that happened in regards to the movie. Okay, so the movie is based on the second and third Oz books, which are The Marvelous Land of Oz and Ozma of Oz. Elements from the former include the introduction of Jack Pumpkinhead, the witch Mombi and her Powder of Life, the conquest of the Emerald City, the escape by the flying sofa, and the search for Princess Ozma. From the latter comes the return of Dorothy, the talking head Belina, the Wheelers, the discovery of TikTok, a princess with interchangeable heads, the introduction of the Gnome King, and the Ornament Room.
So most of it's there in the books.
Yeah.
Even the sofa.
Yeah. She did all her own stunts.
Who?
Firouz Abalt.
Oh, wow.
While filming the sequence near the end of the film where Dorothy rides atop the Cowardly Lion, actress Firouz Abalt became so overwhelmed by the temperature that she passed out on the soundstage. The scene where she falls onto the couch with a thud into the Gnome King's mountain was done in 11 takes.
Hmm.
Director Walter Murch invited friend George Lucas to visit the set one day. During that visit, Lucas wandered to different sound stages where he came across producer Rick McCallum working on a small film. The two became friends and later collaborated on the Star Wars prequels.
It's true. McCallum produced all of those, mm-hmm. didn't he?
Several major characters from the Oz books make cameos in the final parade scene, including the Shaggy Man, The Patchwork Girl, Professor H.M. Wogglebot, T.E., Santa Claus, Tommy Quickstep, Button Bright, and The Musicker. The Musicker.
Santa Claus is an original character of the Oz stories?
It's a major character in the Oz stories. I don't think it's necessarily an original character.
Okay. That's pretty interesting.
He never intended for this film to be viewed as a direct sequel to Wizard of Oz. Rather, he intended it as a partial sequel with some direct references. The ruby slippers, actors playing characters in Oz and the real world, but in closer similarity to the Oz novels. The appearance of the Oz characters, Oz being a real place as opposed to a dream. The misconception that the film was ever meant to emulate the MGM musical probably contributed to its failure at the box office.
Very interesting. Yeah, I don't know if you can... I mean, obviously, the new Oz movie is... I just looked at the numbers. It took $215 million to make it, and it grossed $200 million. So it's going to make money.
Domestically.
Yeah.
That's not overseas. That's just domestically.
So it's going to make money. But I wonder... I mean, it's a totally different thing now. You use a green screen, you can do whatever you want. I wonder if this movie could have ever made money, given the its purpose, its intent, you know, the darker, more novel-based, you know... I saw your eyes get larger for a second.
I was reading some of the trivia. Christopher Lloyd was considered to play the Gnome King, while Louise Fletcher or Mary Steenburgen were considered to play the Princess Mombi. Disney regular of the 70s, Don Knotts, was considered to voice Belina. I would have actually probably been okay with that. And former Disney regular of the 60s, Dick Van Dyke, was considered to voice either Jack Pumpkinhead or the Scarecrow.
He would have been better off doing the Scarecrow.
Yeah.
Jack Pumpkinhead was too... it doesn't have Dick Van Dyke's swagger.
I liked that Jack Pumpkinhead sounded like a boy. It was creepy when he kept calling her mom.
Yeah. Well, but you know what's crazy? Is his real mom is the same age as her in the movie. I mean, the mom thing is a spirit... It's like his spiritual creator.
Right.
It doesn't have to do with...
Mother.
Right. Yeah.
But just the way he treated her... That was just a little weird.
It was weird. I also thought it was kind of sweet, I guess, in a way.
I think just from an adult sensibility, it was weird. I think
it's innocent, I think.
I think a 5-year-old like Aaron would, oh, that's his mommy, you know? And it's like, and that's would be as far as it goes. I'm looking at it, it's like, that's a little weird. That's a little creepy. He's wanting to cuddle with her like it's his mom. What?
Very much an Island of Misfit Toys kind of.
When Dorothy is in the hospital in Kansas, she's kept in room 31 by Nurse Wilson, who played Mombi. Later, when Dorothy is in Oz, Mombi's original head is kept in Cabinet 31.
That's, yeah. One thing I noticed, and I don't know if it's in the trivia, but one of the very subtle things, I think, was that the wheelers were the same as the cart. They made the same noise.
Oh.
Like, that's something that occurred to me when I was watching it.
I didn't realize that. And that would be something that terrified her.
Yeah. The pumpkin was pretty obvious. It was kind of there in that room.
Mm-hmm.
TikTok was the machine's face.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that stuff was all. But the wheelers, I think, was that cart. It made that screeching.
Yeah, I didn't catch on that. That's it. That's good. This film received a mention in Guinness Book of World Records as the sequel that made the longest period, that was made the longest period of time after the original. It was released 46 years after The Wizard of Oz.
Nice. I wonder if that still holds up.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not going to look that up.
Come on, you only have to search 80 years of history, Tony. What's the big deal?
Nah.
We can do it live on the show.
Not going to happen. When the two girls run away from the hospital in 1899, Nurse Wilson chases them with a flashlight, which was not invented until 1902.
I was going to say something about that, and then I forgot, and now this reminded me, yes. So, they have a flashlight, and it did seem a little bit out of place, but it was also a fantasy story. And then the other thing that kills me, though, is you told me it was only off by 2 years. Like, I would have thought the flashlight would have been invented, like, 30 years later.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at some of the goofs right now.
Because I thought that was out of place, but I would have forgiven it 3 years if I would have...
Oh, yeah, that's nothing.
But I thought there's no way a flashlight existed back then. It would have had to have been like the 30s or the 20s or something like that. But no, that's pretty close. So it's actually pretty accurate, really.
Wow. Some people really look at this stuff and like, what? Factual errors. The melting point of silver is 961.70... 0.78 degrees centigrade or 1763.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Its boiling point is 2162 centigrade or 3924 Fahrenheit. Therefore, Dorothy would not have been able to drink, quote, hot liquid silver, unquote, or even hold a cup for that matter.
Well, for crying out loud.
And you know what? She wouldn't have been able to eat limestone cakes either, but she clearly took a bite out of that.
That's the least of your worries with that scenario.
Yeah. At that point, if you haven't suspended your disbelief by the time you get that far into this movie, you have something broken in your head.
I will say, though, it reminded me of a story I saw in 60 Minutes about a man who ingested so much nickel, I believe, he turned blue. The Gnome King looked like that guy. I don't know if it was nickel or something else, but I'm going to try to...
Yes.
Man claims skin treatment turned his face permanent blue. Yeah. All right, now tell me this doesn't look like the Gnome King, dude.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing that guy, Papa Smurf.
Yeah, he's forever blue.
I missed out on this at the beginning of the movie. Apparently, at the beginning of the movie, the nurse takes away Dorothy's lunch pail, which would be
totally makes
why
sense.
She makes that's why she finds the lunch pail tray. But that's apparently one of the revealing mistakes, is the nurse unexpectedly takes away Dorothy's lunch pail, yet before she even reaches for it, Dorothy raises it up as if handing it to her. At one point, Dorothy bumps into the stone cowardly lion and it wobbles back and forth. So one of the things that creeped me out toward the end, when all the people of Oz turned back into real people, they start showing things turning back into what they really were. And then they go to those dancing ladies.
Yeah.
None of them have heads. I was like, oh, this is going to be bad.
But then they got their heads back.
But they got their heads back. I was like, this could go really dark.
Yes. That would be weird. Very weird.
Yeah. All right. You know what? I don't think I have anything else to talk about. You know, I thought this episode, we have now... The recording of this file, which I think I started like a minute or two before we actually started the episode, we're at an hour and 19 minutes. I figured we would have gone about 19 minutes. If you would have asked me
a little bit
before this movie, how much we would talk about it. You know,
there's a lot to talk about in the movie.
I think if all four of us were here, we might have only talked about it 19 minutes.
Yeah, maybe.
I think the conversation would have broke down a lot quicker.
Yeah, Adam would have been like, this is bullshit. And...
Dick.
Yeah, it would have been...
I want to bang that chick. How old is she?
Daryl knew the name of the chicken before we even saw the movie, which told me something about... Maybe he had some information about the movie that he would have been willing to share.
That was interesting.
Well, I'll just add that Walter Murch did win an Academy Award for Best Sound Editing in Apocalypse Now and The Conversation. And that on the thing about whether or not Dorothy could have really eaten the silver, the FDA does not consider colloidal silver safe or effective to treat any disease or condition. In fact, it could also have serious side effects, such as aguria, which is an irreversible blue-gray discoloration of your skin, nails, and gums, seizures and other neurological problems, kidney damage, indigestion, headaches, fatigue, and skin irritation. So, in conclusion... I think it probably was safe to say it was unlikely she could have had the limestone cakes or the liquid silver.
That is a fair assumption.
So, for all you suckers that are still listening 80 minutes in, have a good night.
See ya, and next week we will be talking about Margo.
Ladies.